Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is Julia Glass, who reads from and discusses her new book, I See You Everywhere, published by Random House. In the weeks to come, we have Alice Schroeder, Lewis Sacker, and many more. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a moment. It's time to begin.
Good evening. Welcome to the Tattered Cover, and I want to thank you all for coming tonight, even in the midst of the little cold and rain, and really appreciate you being here and your support of Tattered Cover and other independent bookstores. Well, we're very excited tonight to have author Julia Glass here with her new novel, I See You Everywhere, a riveting and poignant story about two very different sisters that takes place over a 25-year period. As many of you, I'm sure, remember, Julia Glass's debut novel, Three Junes, won the National Book Award for Fiction. And then that was followed by her next book, The Whole World Over, which also received wide acclaim. She has received fellowships from the National Endowments for the Arts, the New York Foundation for the Arts, and the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study. Please help me welcome Julia Glass.
Thank you, Marty. This is the beginning of a 10-day tour, and it's the longest I've been away from my family on book tour. So I'm just kind of getting things together tonight, and I realized I wore a very musical necklace, which I'm not sure is so great. So I may have to remove my necklace, but I'm not going to remove anything else. And you're not missing out on anything. Okay. Now I'm ready. I'm thrilled to be here. This is a wonderful bookstore, and it's my third time at Tattered Cover. The first time I came and participated in an event with several authors at a store that I don't think exists anymore. It was like a giant warehouse of a store. At that time, I lived in New York, and one of the things I learned when I was touring for Three Junes, and I'd lived in New York for about 20 years, and I had that typical New Yorker attitude that, well, if it's a French restaurant, we've got one that's better. If it's, you know, whatever it is, we've got something better. And one of the things I learned when I was out on the road is that, boy, did New York not have the best bookstores in the country. I like to say it's because of real estate, but I had a wonderful treat in store when I went around, and this was, that Tattered Cover was one of my favorite stores, so I'm glad to be here again. Now, this book is a little different from my first two books, and it's quite similar in other ways. And I'm going to start out by I'm going to talk about the book a little bit, and then I'm going to read from the book. And I'm going to start by telling a mom story. It's not a hockey mom story. In fact, it's not even a soccer mom story. And as an aside, I happen to be a badminton mom. I really am. My 12 and 7-year-old boys are avid badminton players, but we're a voter constituency that does not have much clout. So anyway, a couple of months ago, I was out to dinner with my two sons and their father at a local restaurant, and we're sitting in this booth waiting for the waitress to come. And my son Alec, who's 12, and his father are sitting on one side of the booth. And I should say that my son Alec, he's a wonderful boy, but he's reached the age where he's perfected about 6 different ways to roll his eyes, which he generally does at his younger brother, if not at me or his father. But meanwhile, his 7-year-old brother Oliver is still madly in love with mommy. So he's sitting on my side of the booth making googly eyes at me and saying how beautiful I am and how well this blouse suits the color of my eyes. He's actually getting a little scary at the precision of his compliments for someone so young. And you can only imagine the look on his brother's face across the table. It's sort of something like, you know, just spare me. And I see that Alec, the older brother, is about to say something to the younger brother. And what came out of his mouth really surprised me. He said in this very condescending tone, he said, you know, if I were you, I would love me better than you love mom or dad, because you are a whole lot more related to me than you are to mom or dad. And I, you know, my first thought was, wow, the school system's got a great science curriculum. But that wasn't it. So, but here's the thing. I mean, I said, wow, you know, you're actually right. And we talked about genetics and so forth. But afterward, when I got home, I realized that that actually goes to the heart of something that fascinates me as a fiction writer, which is the nature of siblings. And anybody who's read Three Junes must be, would be nodding, because the three McLeod brothers are very much at the center of that novel. I never had brothers. I had one sister. But what fascinates me about siblings in general is that here's this person that you're given. You don't choose to have this person in your life, or these people. My spouse actually is the oldest of six, so he has several siblings. And if you're lucky, that person is a part of your life almost virtually from birth to death. Your siblings know the family mythology. They know all the stories that nobody tells. They've probably really got your number. But as closely related as you are to a sibling, life also sets you up to be rivals in some way. There's almost no way to escape some degree of rivalry or competition with a sibling. And I have to thank Robin Vinemos, am I pronouncing your name correctly, whose very nice review of my book I have just read this afternoon in the Denver Post, who used, or I don't know if it was you or one of the editors who used this word frenemy in the title. I think the title of the review is, what's the title? Best sister, best frenemy or something. No, I didn't get it right. It wasn't you. Well, the funny thing is I've been using that word, which I didn't just discover it, but I'll confess that I get AARP mailings now. And actually, I really like their magazine a lot because all these really cool movie stars are on the cover. They may not seem really cool to my sons, but to me, they're still really young. They're my age, and they're really young, and there they are on the cover. But the most recent issue has a glossary in the back of kids speak. And one of the words in the glossary is frenemy. And I've heard this word, but when I saw the definition, I realized that that really describes the nature of siblingship for a lot of people. It's someone you really love who really knows how to hurt you. And so I decided that I was, I'm going to go back actually a little bit here to talk about this book, because what many people may not realize about this book is that some of it was written before I wrote Three Junes. Some of it came together as a collection of linked stories. And again, Robin is one of the few critics who has actually noticed that. It's not called a novel. You know, often the publisher, in fact, almost always, they tell you what you're reading. It says a novel or stories or a novel in stories. But years ago, in the early 1990s, when I was writing nothing but short fiction, sure that I was a short story writer, but writing these short stories that meandered on and on forever, one of the first stories I wrote was actually about two sisters, and it was very much based on me and my sister. I wrote, as many beginning fledgling fiction writers do, I drew much more overtly from my own life. And after 7 years of trying to get a story published, sending them out to the New Yorker, the Atlantic, but to all kinds of quarterlies, you know, eensy little broadsides called things like The Drunken Osprey in North Dakota. And I just got rejection after rejection after rejection. And the story after 7 years that was finally published was a story called My Sister's Scar, which was about these two sisters, Louisa and Clement Jardine. And that was actually about the same time that my own sister took her own life. And she was 31 and I was 36. And it was a huge blow for my family, of course. It was quite unexpected. And as I went through the early stages of the mourning over her, this story, My Sister's Scar, which was my, at that time, only published story, had won a runner-up prize in a short story competition called the Nelson Algren Award. And it's a wonderful award. If any of you are aspiring writers, it's a short story award where they give not just a big award, but they give three smaller awards. And they fly all four writers out to Chicago for a gala evening. The stories are published in a supplement to the paper that comes out on a Sunday in October. And it's a wonderful affirmation because you not only do you get to see your writing there on the page, and yes, it's newsprint, very ephemeral, but you're celebrated by the Chicago Tribune Literary Foundation. So it was a really important moment in my life. My sister had just died. There were other things going on in my life that were not happy. But after the award ceremony, the winners went out to dinner with the judges, and one of the judges turned to me and said, you know, these two sisters absolutely fascinate me. I haven't seen a lot of writing about this kind of relationship, and I wonder if you might write other stories about them. And this really hadn't occurred to me. But I went back to New York and I thought, you know, maybe it would be therapeutic, if nothing else, for me to continue with these two sisters. And so I did, and I wrote a few more stories, and a couple of them were published, nowhere fancy. But at the same time, I began to realize that if I wanted to get a book published, I was going to have to write a novel. And I really didn't see making a novel out of these two characters' lives. And that's when I wrote Three Junes. So I turned away from these, what I thought of as my sister stories, and I wrote Three Junes, of course, about three brothers, among other things. And then Three Junes became a success, and I thought, well, now I'll write that sister's book. I'll put together those stories and I'll write some more. And my publisher said, no, wait, we will publish those, but we would like another novel. And again, it didn't occur to me that this could make a novel, so I wrote The Whole World Over, my second book. And so really, not until a few years ago did I finally turn back to these stories. And I realized, first of all, that it was a good thing that all this time had gone by, because when you borrow so heavily from your own life, it's good to have distance on it. I suppose it's like a wine aging in a cellar, but that material from my life, I could really cast a long glance on it. I had much more perspective than if I had written the book sooner. So, and I also had to ask myself, did I really want to write a memoir? And the answer to myself was no, because I didn't want to undertake an investigation about my sister's death. I mean, a psychological investigation, which is what I think a memoir would have had to be. I wanted to write about the texture of a certain kind of sibling relationship in which you love someone very much who's very, very different from you, and with whom you're often, if not at war, there's a great deal of friction between you. And so I wrote some more of these stories, and I pulled out the old stories. And in working on them very closely for a couple of years, and I'll tell you, it's kind of frightening to pull out writing you haven't looked at in 10 years. I was so appalled. You know, it's like the bad news and the good news at once. You know, wow, had I improved as a writer. But I'm also a good editor, so I really went to town on those stories, even the one that had been published in the Chicago Tribune. And when I turned the manuscript into my publisher a couple of years ago, I went out to lunch with my editor and her boss, and they said, listen, when we read this book, we feel that these, they called them chapters, are much closer, more closely intermeshed than short stories. And we don't really think of it as linked stories. And my heart sank because I thought, you know, this is not a novel. It's, if you think of a novel as a movie, this is more like a slideshow. And so they said, no, we have no intention of marketing this book as a novel, but we're just not going to say what it is. We're just going to call it your new book. Well, every critic so far but Robin has called it a novel, and I'm, you know, what am I going to do, go out there and quibble? But the funny thing is that if you do see it as a novel, it could have been my first book if I had made it a novel. And yet I think, you know, serendipitously, it wasn't my first novel. So it's my third book, and it's sort of a novel but not really a novel. And without making further excuses, I'll read from it. Now, the stories, or chapters, or episodes, or whatever you want to call them, alternate point of view between the two sisters. The older sister is named Louisa Jardine, and the younger sister is Clem Jardine, and they have very different personalities. Louisa is a typical oldest, more of a, if not a conformist, she's a good citizen, very conscientious, you know, a little broom up the ass, just to be frank. And her younger sister is the wild one, the nonconformist, but also a scientist, whereas the older sister is more of an artist. So I am going to read from the beginning of a story, which is the title story or chapter, called, which is called I See You Everywhere. And it takes place in 1990, and it's told from the point of view of Clem, the younger sister. And I think the only thing you need to know before I read this, I mean, you really don't need to know anything, but I'll say anyway that Louisa, the older sister, is living in New York, working as an art critic, and she is married to a man named Hugh, whose name is mentioned briefly. I have to get the mic, so I'm, this is always tricky, trying not to look through the microphone to read. I See You Everywhere, 1990. Safety pinned to my blanket is a pink While You Were Out slip. An out, I'm to learn, of titanic proportion. Your sister called, loves you very much, coming by train TMW. I puzzle thickly over those three letters. Tramway? Tomahawk? Tunisian Motor Works? My mind feels like a fly-mobbed garbage barge plowing through a sea of tar. At the foot of a strange bed, a strange window. Leafy branches, bright sky, parking lot of blinding glitter. Pinstriped curtains wall me in. My right arm is in a cast. From my left hand, an IV snakes its way up to a large crystalline prune. Hydration, my brain remarks, the word flashing out, a lighthouse on my sea of tar. I turn my head to another flash, this one exuberant pain, and there's an electrocardiograph showing the placid skip to my loo of a healthy heartbeat. EKG, my brain instructs, each letter another beacon, a tiny gem in the murk. Wow, so this is amnesia. But now I recognize the woman asleep in the strange chair by the strange window. My name, my profession, the goings-on in my life. I seem to know all these things and am vaguely disappointed that I do. Except for Jerry. Hot as a short-order skillet, Jerry. The pink note still clings to my thigh. Oh, tomorrow. Shit. A whisper, but against the white noise of life support, stunning. In a flash, my mother's awake and pressing a hand to my forehead. Honey, honey, it's you. Like I'd be who? Mick Jagger? I sound like wheels on gravel. Don't talk. Save your energy, sweetheart. She pulls back the curtain and calls out, Gwen, she's with us at last. She's here. Someone shushes her gently. Before she lets the curtain fall, I see half a dozen beds in a long arc, some tented, all flanked by machines. Mom scrapes her chair up beside me. She clearly wants to take my hand, but both are already taken, one by the IV, the other by a sling. You're in the hospital, says Mom, as if I might think we're in a pool hall or car wash. You've had an accident, but you're going to be fine. I am about to say, Jesus, Mom, what hospital, what accident, when she puts a finger to my lips. Please, sweetheart, in a minute I'll call Dad. He had to go home to dry dock a friendship and feed the horses. Again, I take stock. My father runs three boat yards. My mother is an accomplished rider, a master of foxhounds. They live on Pemaquisset Point in Rhode Island, where I grew up. These swatches of knowledge are safely intact, that part of my cerebral quilt unfrayed. But the now of my life, as I know it, takes place largely in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, where I am staying with Jerry while I figure out where my next job's going to be. Jerry says that maybe I should figure out first why I change jobs so often, especially since I never get fired. A nurse enters my tiny lair. Well, well. 40 winks and then some. She wrangles a pressure cuff onto my cast-free arm. As she leans across me, I see her badge. Her name is Gwendolyn Treble. She is a blizzard of freckles. In person. The flash of her ID photo bleached them all out. And we are at the hospital in Boston that my father, who went to Harvard and had a broken femur set in this place, calls Pooh Bah General. My brain flings out the weirdest details. "Excuse me," I say, figuring she will be more helpful than my mother. But then a man in a white coat pops in behind her. "Well, well," I hear again, as if it's a password. "And how do you feel?" "Caved in," I say, straining to enunciate, "kicked by a Clydesdale." He laughs, a small, mannerly laugh. Vocabulary, an excellent sign. He leans in from the foot of my bed and holds out a pen, moves it back and forth before my eyes. Then he untucks the bedding, pulls it up to my ankles, and uses his all-purpose pen to stroke the soles of my feet. When I flinch, he winks. "Guess we'll forego amputation." Finally, he puts his hands around my neck, hands as cool and dry as a lizard. He seems to be making sure my skull is still attached to my spine. His badge tells me he is Eric Slocum, Chief Res Emerg Med. His clipboard, now on the table beside my bed, tells me today is July 28th. But wait, that date is more than a month in the future, isn't it? "Doctor, excuse me, but have I been out cold for a month?" He watches the ceiling while taking my pulse. "We don't know why you aren't a lot worse off. You are a very lucky young lady with a noggin of grade A granite and a pair of very resilient lungs." Real conversations with these people are going to be difficult. But then, I've been at the mercy of doctors before. I know their game of bait and switch. Mom's eyes are swollen. Weeping isn't her style, so something serious happened here. She is a woman made of gristle, pumice, and more than the customary dash of testosterone. If my noggin's made of granite, her genes are to thank. She believes in the supremacy of genes. That gene I got from her, too. Jerry is in the business of genes. I had never wanted a guy the way I wanted Jerry, almost the minute I met him. I was feverish, crazy, jealous of everything he touched, from his cat to his phone to the steering wheel in his Jeep. By nature, genes again. I am far too skeptical, too bound by gravity to ever get swept off my feet. But if anyone's come near, it's Jerry. Jerry is a high-tech veterinarian. He flies around the country and orchestrates in vitro breeding of pedigreed cattle and horses, from genetic counseling to the carefully engineered reproductive moment of truth. His dream is to do the same for lions on the Serengeti. I met Jerry last winter in Augusta, Maine. I was alone in a bar, consoling myself after a disastrous interview for a job I might have had tagging moose. Till now, my work has taken place on the ocean. But lately I've been restless for the reassuring enclosure of mountains and lakes. And the ocean is becoming too politically charged. Overfishing, nuclear testing, PCBs, and a mulish nostalgia for whaling have all conspired to make the practice of Darwin-style biology next to impossible. We got talking about something predictably high-minded, like the dawning obsolescence of wilderness. He was wearing a bolo tie, a Ridley sea turtle treading water at the throat of his denim shirt, under the reef of a coral red beard. I remember wanting desperately to impress him. That's not like me, so I was partly hooked, partly annoyed. We'd been talking less than an hour, had moved on to Richard Dawkins and selfish genes, when Jerry admired my earrings, tear-shaped slabs of turquoise hanging from silver studs. "How'd I look in one of those?" he said. He reached out and gently unfastened my right earring. I was acutely aware of his calloused fingertips, of his beard like fiery sagebrush grazing my face. Not a soft square inch on the man except this pair of blue eyes, a blue like bridesmaid satin. I expected him to turn toward the mirror behind the bottles and hold the earring up for show, but instead he set it down. When he took an ice cube out of his scotch and held it to his right earlobe, I laughed and said, "You are bluffing." Merely smiling, he put the ice cube on the bar where it slid aimlessly away. He took the earring and, just like that, pushed it through. The noise was faint but excruciating, a cell of bubble wrap popping. He did not blink. "Now we're a package," he said, pressing our naked ears together and facing us toward the mirror. "Siamese, inseparable." "Get away!" I shoved him, but I was laughing hysterically. The part of me that was hooked had just won me over against all survivalist caution, of which I've been told I possess next to none. Just like that, I've lost a month of my life, sloughed off my frontal lobe like snow shearing off an ice floe in May. Other people fill in the details, but what do you believe? One incidental thing I'd like to remember: the helicopter ride to the hospital, a chopper careening up the muscle man arm of the Cape. "Ride 'em, cowboy. Woo-ha!" My mother says, "No, you would not want to remember, honey. Believe you me, you were in a lot of pain. Sometimes God is merciful. God or whoever. Whatever." She is a Minnesota-born Presbyterian and goes to church only on Easter and Christmas Eve. She went a lot more often when Louisa and I were small to make sure we had our full dose of Sunday school, like a course of antibiotics. But she could never drag our father along, not even for the Hallelujah Chorus by candlelight. He is not swayed by bravura or sentiment, least of all by a merger. In this way, at least, I am his daughter. The afternoon is ruthlessly long. There is no conversation around me, and the fading light outside has no impact on the homogenized glare within. Dinner, equally dull, might as well be intravenous. And afterward, every time I drift toward sleep, Gwen or some resident pokes me, or I hear another patient in distress. Even if I had the energy to complain, I'd feel like a brat. It's no secret that some of my companions here, just beyond my curtain, are going to die. Die right here and soon. That's why they're here. They're like planes in a holding pattern over an airport, waiting their turn to land. This doesn't spook me. I think about death sometimes as a state of respite. But I know that I'm moving away from them, that I'll make it out of here. At which point, I'll face another struggle. Best not to think about that now. Louisa's smart. Smarter than me in the report card sense. But whenever she's nervous, she babbles. Today, day two of my renewed consciousness, she's worse than ever, as if she's burning off extra fuel. I guess she's just glad I'm alive. And if I weren't so drugged up, I hope I'd be touched. "So I get home," she's saying. "Hugh's already asleep. I've had too much wine. And what do I find on the machine but one of Mom's classic soliloquies? Something like, 'Clem's been in a serious accident, honey. I'm not at home because I'm here with her, and your father's back and forth because there's a hurricane off Bermuda. Ethan or Ephraim, I think. Your father says it's a bad sign that here we are not even August and already up to E. C and D passed us by, but B was a very close call. Great for the roses, though. You can't speak to her, I'm afraid, but call this number. I'm giving you this number. Just a sec. Hang on, it's here in my purse. Is it as hot down there as it is up here? Yes, here it is. Right. So call and say you love her. Will you do that, please? She can't talk, but have them leave her a message. I'll call you later." Louisa stops pacing. "So, of course I have no idea where here is or who they are, but I call the number. I'm frantic, and this woman answers, 'I see you,' as if I'm expected to answer, 'Aha, but I see you too.' Like a game of some kind. All I can say is, 'You see me? How?' And she laughs. 'That's a new one,' she says. 'This is intensive care.' And I freak out. I can't believe she's laughing." "That's cute," I say. "Like, I see you in my dreams. I see you on the Johnny Carson show. I see you everywhere." Louisa says, more like, I see you every time all hell breaks loose for both of us. Yeah, well, life is never dull. I'm too slow to pick up on the second half of what she said, the part about both of us. But later, when I'm alone, it comes back, and I tell myself, remember to ask her. This is like trying to leave a footprint in sludge. Sometimes I wish you'd let it be dull, just for a change. Louisa puts a hand on my leg. Are you in a lot of pain? Can I get you anything from the outside world? Mom's buying books, since they say you'll be in here a while. I have a concussion. You can't read with a concussion. And no, the pain is just sort of predictably there. Not too much, not too little. I know what drugs to ask for, but thanks. What I want from the outside world, of course, is Jerry, Jerry, Jerry. Why isn't he here? Because no one told him. Who would tell him? I've kept him to myself for months, not because he isn't important to me, because there's so much at stake. That's when I clam up. I interrupt my sister's running commentary. She's acting weirdly jumpy. Louisa, can you make a call for me? I can't have a phone till I'm in a regular room. Miraculously, I recite his number. Who's Jerry? A guy I met who... Can you please just call him and tell him where I am? For once, I don't get her patent-pending look of disapproval. Anything you need. Today, I'm your slave. She smiles and lowers her voice. Your go-between. I feel sorry for her, but it passes. Louisa's married, and before that, her love life was never too complex. When I see her these days, I keep waiting for her to tell me she's having a baby. It's way beyond time. I don't think Dr. Slocum's superiors would like how familiar he is, the casual way he sits on my bed, twiddling his stethoscope. He's just told me that I was in an accident during a sailboat race off Westport, Massachusetts, on July 25th. You do sail, he says coyly, in response to my shock. Yes, I sail, I say, perhaps rudely, but I have never been in a race. I grew up around boats, but I'm not the yachting type. I've sailed to do research. Research? His eyebrows raised sprout tiny projectile tufts. Other than this hint of vampire, he is Ken Doll handsome, down to his patent leather hair. Whales and seals, until the money for my last job dried up. I was in California, the last place you want a state-funded job right now. Ah, he looks impressed, though I doubt he is. He writes something down. If doctors are impressed, a rare event, it's by artists, acrobats, athletes. Any science other than medicine has the cachet of hand-me-down clothing with perspiration stains. I want to ask again about the race, but stop myself. Best not to invite more concern than I want from this guy. Now he is telling me that I was unconscious when I came off the chopper, but talking nonstop. What was I saying? According to the EMT who took your vitals, it was mostly nonsense, but weirdly intelligible. He looks at his notes. When I arrived, you were asking for Band-Aids and coleslaw. And there was something about Krishna sloughing. He leans closer. Are you fond of coleslaw? Are you a Hindu? What I am is tired. Is he actually flirting? He knocks on one of my shins as if to see who's home. I can feel that, in case you've reserved a wheelchair. He laughs nervously. Dr. A will be through in an hour. One more night without further complications, and we are copacetic. Upstairs you go. Dr. Slocum nods at the hills and valleys of my cardiograph. Sound as a Sousa march. Earlier today, I flipped through the printouts on the clipboard tied to the head of my bed. They looked more like the Tetons my first day in. A solo by Max Roach. Gwendolyn taking good care of you? Everything to your satisfaction? Just swell. I'd turn down Mar-a-Lago to be here. Atta girl. He knocks on my shin again and finally leaves. Coleslaw is the name of Jerry's old tomcat, who is missing so many teeth that he emits, when he sleeps between us, a snore as loud and jagged as a wood chipper mauling a dead Christmas tree. Krishna is the mainsail of the gannet, orange like the robes of the bald guys who chant and beat tambourines. Krishna's luffing, I must have said. The gannet is the sailboat on which I helped record whale songs 8 years ago, the summer my uterus lost access to an ovary, the summer I fled Luke and his first proposal of marriage. Two reunions, two breakups lay ahead of us yet. Not that I wasn't working my tail off. The crew had names for everything. The galley stove was Pele because of its volatile nature. The keel, Great Whitey, because the captain said it was sure as a shark. The head, my favorite, was Tricky Dick, Nix for short, because it liked to spit back at opportune moments. Thank you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fodum. We've been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for Alice Schroeder, Lewis Sacker, and many more as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on October 20th, 2008.